Walt Frazier was one of the early superstars of the National Basketball Association and one of the outstanding guards in basketball history. For 10 years, he played for the New York Knicks, a team that built their game around defense. The Knicks won their first NBA championship in 1970. That season, Frazier was voted best defensive player by the NBA and ranked second in scoring. Off the court, Frazier was a cool man about town, sporting a black mink coat, driving a pink Eldorado. Frazier was traded to Cleveland in 1977 and retired from basketball shortly after. Now he's back in the game as a commentator for the Madison Square Garden cable network. Last year, Frazier was inducted into the Hall of Fame. Walt Frazier has just written a memoir about the 1969-70 championship season. It's called Walt Frazier, One Magic Season and a Basketball Life, and it's co-authored with Neil Offen. Frazier might have become a football player. He was offered a football college scholarship, but he turned it down.
I wasn't that fast. And not being a pioneer, because in those days there were no black quarterbacks in the NFL, so I assumed my best chance to make it to the professional ranks would be as a basketball player.
So you knew you'd stand a better chance of making it in basketball?
Yes.
You joined the New York Knicks in 1967, and I think it was in the middle of that season that Red Holtzman became the coach. You really liked him right off, and one of the things you liked him for was being tough. In what ways was he tougher on the players than the coach that preceded him?
Well, he was tough in that there was only one set of rules for the superstars, and there was only one set of rules for the rookies, so I admired that because he didn't play favorites. Everybody had to abide by the rules, and that's what I was accustomed to throughout my career. And I like rules and regulations. I like a structured system of discipline. So when Holtzman took over, that was his philosophy, and I strived under that principle. He instilled a lot of confidence in me, and he also came in with the tough defense assignments that the Knicks would pick up guys all over the floor and pressure them. And that was my thing, being a good defensive player. So that enabled me to get more playing time. And by doing that, I gained my confidence. And, the rest is history. I became a superstar player.
Was defense always your game?
Well, it's ironic how it happened. My sophomore year in college, I was very successful, and I got the big head. I didn't go to class, so I became ineligible. So the next season that I did not play, the coach made me play defense every day, sort of as a punishment for not making grades. And one day I decided that if I'm going to play defense, I'm going to be the best defensive player there is. So I perfected my skills in mastering the fundamentals of defense, see the ball, see your man. I really got into perfecting my stance, which is a staggered stance that you play on defense. And that whole season, like I said, I just played defense, so I began to like it.
When you were playing with the Knicks, how would you psych out the person you were guarding?
Mainly, at times, I would psych them out by allowing them early on in the game to get away with certain things when I knew that I could steal the ball. But if you stole a ball, say, in the first half, it doesn't mean anything because the guys get over it. But if you steal the ball, say, in the last 5 minutes or at a crucial time in the fourth quarter, it can turn the game around. So that's how I really psych guys, in that I would let them do things early on in the game, setting them up for that key time in the fourth quarter when the steal would mean something, and then I would make it.
You were a great stealer.
I attribute that to, I often tell people, when you grow up in a large family like I did, I have seven sisters and one brother, it helps to have quick hands.
Well, they weren't keeping statistics on stealing when you were playing, but there are statistics on that. Now, do you think that stealing is key to a good defense?
No, but it can be very devastating. Today, you see very few steals because the advent of defense is not as prevalent when I play. Defense is becoming somewhat of a lost art in today's game because everything is predicated on offense and showtime and dunk shots. So the fans of this era would like to see more exciting basketball. They're not into defense. But a defense, when you can steal the ball from a professional player, it's very devastating, and the crowd used to love it when I did it at Madison Square Garden.
Now, what kind of opening would you look for to know that you could steal a ball?
Whenever a person dribbles the ball, you should always protect the ball with your body. But like I said, I would set guys up so they would get comfortable in having the ball out in front of them. And when you do that, then you're vulnerable to a steal. Another thing I would do is that I'd always made my steals from when a player was dribbling from left to right, because then I could tap the ball away from him without my body making contact to draw a foul.
Mm-hmm. Walt Frazier is my guest. He was one of the star players of the Knicks. He's written a new autobiography called Walt Frazier, One Magic Season and a Basketball Life. Now, another thing that you became really famous for was kind of thriving under pressure. You tell a great story in your book about scoring the winning points in foul shots with 2 seconds left in the game that that broke a record for winning streaks. You won 18 games in a row. And so you were the one who scored the winning points for that. What went through your mind when you were making those foul shots with 2 seconds left? You had three chances, and you knew you had to make it.
Well, what happened was I made a steal late in the game, and in attempting to shoot the ball, I was fouled. So I was knocked to the floor. There was like 1 second left on the clock. And I looked up and I said, God, why didn't that ball go in? Because I realized now I must go to the line and make these shots. So, of course, I was supposed to be a cool guy, you know, so I go up to the line very cool. But inside, I'm dying, you know what I'm saying? Come on, God, please help me out of this. Because I know if I don't make these shots, there's no way that I can go in our locker room after the game. So the first one, I'm very cool, and I shoot it, and it goes in. So then I knew the worst thing that could happen is that the game would be tied because I've tied the score. And I still had two more shots. And, of course, I sank the second one, you know, and I looked very cool. Like, hey, this was easy. There was no pressure on me at all.
When you're standing there and it's time to shoot the foul shot, do you give yourself a few seconds to think first? And do you know when it's time to actually make the shot?
Yeah, well, you take a deep breath and try to relax. But what happened in that game, the other team called a timeout to, like, psych me. So they called timeout just before I was to shoot my fouls just so I could go to the bench and think about it, you know. So I went up there and I just, you know, take a few deep breaths and, like, shake your fingers, try to get the tension out of your shoulders, and then you go to the basics. The basics of shooting a free throw is you shoot for the front or the back of the rim. You try to follow through, and you bend your knees. So I just ran that through my mind, like, okay, Clyde, you got to do the basics. Just go back, take your time, relax, concentrate.
You said that if you missed these shots, you knew you wouldn't be able to go into the Knicks locker room.
Right.
But really, what? I'm sure you had been in that position where you blew a shot at some time in your career. What is it like when you go into the locker room and you helped lose a game?
It's quiet. There's silence. No one looks at you. A few people will pat you on the back, but you know they're just trying to help you out. And inside, you feel terrible. And, of course, the coach would come over and say, we'll get him next time. And some of the other guys will give you encouragement. But that doesn't help the pain at that time. It's very excruciating when you know that you blew the game. And in this situation, with an 18-game winning streak on the line, that's why it was so monumental. Like, I didn't want to be the guy to break the string in this way.
Mm-hmm. Did you used to get superstitious when you were on a winning streak?
No question. Excuse me. During that time, everybody did everything the same way. We all dressed the same way. We stayed in the same locker, put our shoes on, and different guys went out at the same time, and the coach wore the same tie and shirt. So we became very superstitious during that winning streak.
You're how tall, around 6'4"?
Yes.
When you were playing, that was, I guess, more or less an average height. I think the height's gotten a lot taller now in basketball. You describe the first time you met Lou Alcindor and how tall he seemed and how uncomfortable he was in your car and how awkward he seemed about his height. Height seems to have really changed a lot in the game.
Today, the average height is 6'7" for an NBA player, and that's one of the noticeable changes in the game, that the guys are so much bigger, stronger, and faster. And they can do the same things that I did at a shorter height. So it's really incredible when I watch these guys to see them perform today.
You say in your book you're glad you're not playing now.
Well, I think there's less discipline. Like I said, I like a structured system. I like to play defense. I like a team-oriented game. And today that's somewhat lacking.
How did you get the nickname of Clyde?
Clyde is my fashion image. If you saw the movie Bonnie and Clyde, I started out wearing those wide-brim hats like Clyde and the two-tone shoes and the double-breasted suits. And I wore fur coats and a Rolls Royce, so they started to call me Clyde as soon as the movie came out, and I was dressing that way.
Do you still dress that way?
Occasionally. I think with age, Clyde kind of faded into the background. That was a fun time in my life, and my philosophy was, whenever you saw me dressed up, I played the way that I looked, and during those days, we were playing well, so I was always dressed out, going out on the town. Now that I'm older, I still have the Rolls and I have the mink coats, but they don't mean the same. They aren't. I'm not into materialistic things like I used to be. So in those days, I would never go anywhere unless I went up in my Rolls Royce. And today I showed up in a cab. So, you know, I've changed quite a bit.
I noticed that you still think of yourself as Clyde, because before you were saying, I said to myself, Clyde.
Yeah, Clyde is, I think everyone has two different personalities. Okay, Walt Frazier is a very quiet and shy person, which basically I am all the time. Clyde was a guy that liked the limelight, and he seeked the limelight. And he would usually come on around 12 a.m. I would start hitting the spots in New York, and I like to go out and mingle with my fans, and I like to go dancing with pretty girls and, you know, just have a good time, and that's what I was into. But I never did that when the Knicks were losing, because it wasn't the same. I always realized and understood that I was in New York to win basketball games, and when I wasn't winning, the music didn't sound as good, and I didn't like to dress up, and I just stayed home.
Do people give you free drinks when you're not winning?
There was a period in New York for 5 years that I could not spend any money. I would go to a restaurant, and when the meal was over, I would attempt to pay, and they say, it's okay, somebody paid for it, or they were constantly sending champagne over to my table. And even today, now that the Knicks are coming back into prominence, just the other day I was down buying a paper, and the lady goes, that's okay, you don't have to pay for it. So whenever New York teams are winning, that's the beauty of playing in New York, that you get a lot of things carte blanche.
And when you're losing?
Well, when you're losing, you must pay. But I think that's fair. I think, well, I don't necessarily say people should give us things, but I think in New York, when you're winning, they give you the town, and when you're losing, they're tough on you. So I think it's fair. Whereas most players think that New York isn't a good place to play because the people are so critical. But they don't realize, or they don't look at it the way that I do. But when you win in New York, you're on every magazine cover throughout the country. People really know you. So I think it's only right that when you don't perform up to standard, that they should criticize you.
In your memoir, you write that whenever it was convenient, you had sex, but not the night before games.
Well, I try to display discipline. And one incident in high school got me that way. One time I walked my girlfriend home, which was about 2 or 3 miles after school, and we had a game that night, so I had to walk back. And that game I played terrible, and we lost. And I never forgave myself for letting the team down. Like, my legs were so tired from all the walking. So after that time, I never associated, you know, with women or anything before a game, like having sex or just out having a good time. I always go home and I get my rest.
You got a divorce while you were playing with the Knicks, and I think that you said you'd never remarry while you were still playing basketball because there were too many temptations.
There were too many temptations, and I'm too moody. Like I said, when we're winning, I'm a nice guy to get along with, but when we're losing, I go and I become a recluse. I don't go out. I don't talk to people, and I didn't want to subject anybody to my moodiness.
You were traded. When you were 32 years old, you were traded to Cleveland, and the coach at that time was one of your former teammates, Willis Reed. Were you really angry when you were traded?
I was very disappointed because I wanted to end my career in New York, and I'd never thought about being traded. I mean, I'd played 10 years for the Knicks, and my name was synonymous with the New York Knicks. And the other exasperating part of it was that my former teammate traded me. And he did not tell me. I had to find out from my agent that I had been traded. So it was devastating in that respect, that someone that you played with and you had so many good times with, that they didn't have the courtesy to come up and tell you that you'd been traded.
You considered retiring instead of moving.
Yeah, like I said, the devastation of it, I said, well, I guess I'll retire. But after 3 or 4 days of getting over the initial shock and looking at Cleveland on paper, that was the best team that you know, I could possibly go on to. They needed a player of my caliber, so I went to Cleveland.
How were you changed by playing for Cleveland?
It was a dramatic change in my life because I was no longer Clyde. Cleveland is not New York, and when there's 10 inches of snow on the ground, there's no place that I want to go. So I became a homebody, and I started to do things I never did in New York, like sit in my living room and read a book or play backgammon. I became Walt again, the quiet, shy guy. And I realized that I only had 2 more years to play, so I started to read a lot of self-help books, things that could help me try to smooth the transition when I was no longer a player.
You say it's hard to get old in a young man's game, and for a lot of players after they turn 30, the younger players look at them like they're old men. Did you start to feel that way at any point in your career?
I did. The fun part of the game was gone for me. It became a job. I dreaded practice. I dreaded going to the games. And that was something that I'd never felt. Like, throughout my career, I enjoyed working out. I mean, I loved basketball. I loved working out, being, you know, the camaraderie with the players. And that was missing in Cleveland. I just didn't have it, and I knew it was time to go.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. Basketball Hall of Famer Walt Frazier is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Basketball Hall of Famer Walt Frazier is my guest. He played with the Knicks for 10 years, joined the team in 67, and became one of the star players. He just written a memoir called Walt Frazier, One Magic Season and a Basketball Life. Let's talk about growing up a little bit and how you learned the game. Did you learn the game in schoolyards?
Yes. As a youngster, I was always on the playground. If you ever went to my house and asked my mother where was I, she'd say, go down to the playground. He's down there. Because from sun up to sundown, that's what all the kids in the neighborhood would do. And basketball season was basketball, and baseball season, baseball, football. If it rained, we played checkers or Scrabbles or Pollyanna or some of the other games. So our whole life was sports, and all the kids were on the playground. And that's where I developed my game, from playing the other kids in the neighborhood. And, of course, I was considered one of the top players, you know, in the area. But my thing was, most of the older guys took me under their wing. Like, they would never let me get in any trouble. And in those days, trouble was smoking a cigarette or trying to shoot dice. They would always run me home because they said, you're going to be an athlete, so you can't do this stuff. So those guys constantly kept me out of trouble, and they just helped me perfect my skills in the sports area.
Well, your father, you say, controlled some of the numbers in Atlanta where you lived. Was he a good example in that sense of not getting into trouble?
Well, at that time I was too young to know. I didn't know about that. So my father never actually taught me sports, anything like that. He would buy me tickets to go to the games and things, but he never actually participated with me.
When you were growing up in Georgia, you played on segregated teams?
Yes.
Was it difficult to really measure how good you were when you couldn't play against all the athletes in your city or all the athletes in the high schools?
Yeah, indeed it was, because when I read the paper, say the Atlanta Constitution, which was the local white paper, I never saw my name because they never covered our game. So I assumed that those guys that I read about was better than I was. So I never thought I would be a professional player because of that. No one ever really scouted us except the other black schools. So you assume that you're sort of inferior as an athlete. And, you know, you don't think you have a chance really to make it to the big time.
So college was the first time you played on an integrated team?
Yes. Yeah, college was the first time I'd ever been around white people at all, other than seeing them in a grocery store. You know, at that time we had to ride the back of the bus, and we had separate water fountains and that type of thing. So I didn't have any communication with white people until I went to college.
Was it a conscious choice to go to an integrated college as opposed to one of the black colleges?
Well, my parents talked me into doing that because they felt I would get a better education. And, of course, I was petrified. I was saying, wow, you know, I didn't feel comfortable around white people naturally because I'd never been around them. And the other thing I found, that I was so far behind academically. Certain things that they took for granted, like math and English and speaking in front of the class, I'd never had. So I was really lost in my classes. And only once basketball season started and people started to know me and then I started to get tutors that I hung on. But there were many nights that I cried and I wanted to go home.
Well, you write that you actually thought about dropping out. And I thought this was interesting. You went back to your old neighborhood and you saw some of the good basketball players, some of the older players had just been hanging around and putting on weight. And that really depressed you and kind of scared you.
Right, because I didn't want to end up like them. And, you know, at first, my freshman year, I admired those guys because they had all the big cars and they were dressing fine and they had all the girls. And I can recall when I came home from the summer to work, I wouldn't go out. My mother used to tell me, why don't you go out? You know, you get outside and get some air. And I was like embarrassed because these guys had all the nice clothes and I was still wearing button-down shirts like college stuff and penny loafers, and these guys were having alligator shoes on. So I wouldn't go out, but I would work like 12 hours a day at this place just to make money to go back to school. So when I was thinking about leaving college and I went back, I saw these same guys. They no longer had that money. They were, a lot of them were alcoholics and into drugs. A lot of my friends were dead or in jail. So I said, hey, I don't want this. I better go back to school someplace.
It's interesting. Your son plays basketball for the University of Pennsylvania now, an Ivy League school.
Yeah, it is, and I'm very proud of him. I don't think he has NBA talent, but I prefer that he's a good student like he is because I know his future would be secure if he graduates from Penn, which he will next year. So it's something I'm very proud of. But he desperately wants to be an NBA player. And like all kids growing up, unfortunately, I didn't grow up with him because I was separated from his mother right after college. But I used to keep him during the summer, and I tried to stress to him the importance of health and diet because he was always a chunky kid. He liked to eat too much, so I tried to talk to him about the proper diet and being motivated, like trying to instill in him what you want to do. You have to work hard to do it. You can't take a break. So I can recall when I used to go to his room, I was still playing, so I used to jog religiously every day. So I would knock on his door, Walt, would you want to jog? He goes, nah, man, I'm on vacation. You know, meaning that school was out and he didn't see any need to be practicing because basketball season was like 2 or 3 months away. So I tried to explain to him about the kids in Harlem and all the other players that will make it to the NBA. They pay a certain price. And now he's realizing what I meant because he sees that he's a step slow because he didn't work on his diet and that he didn't work hard enough to develop his quickness.
Walt Frazier is my guest. You are, I think, among the first generation of basketball players to earn a lot of money and to really become celebrities. A lot of people didn't know what to do with their money and spent it all or squandered it in some way. Especially, you know, if you go from poverty to wealth, you don't really know how to manage money. What did you do? Did you get someone to invest for you to handle your money?
Well, I was lucky. I squandered a lot on clothes. But basically, that was my only vice, was buying clothes because I didn't smoke, I didn't drink. And the rest of it, I used to take care of my brothers and sisters and my mother to make them comfortable. And I made mistakes as well, but I rebounded from them. I mean, I had unscrupulous people dealing with my monies at times, and I made some losses, but I rebounded. So I've been fortunate in that respect. A lot of our players are broke because part of it is their fault because they live a high life. They live a high standard with drugs and buying a lot of fancy material things. And then, of course, they get ripped off by agents or whatever. And I found that I'm making money now because of my reputation by being a good person and not being involved with drugs, being concerned about our youth. As a player, I was always into kids and trying to help them, so people are willing to help me now, and that has paid off for me. But basically, I was just a lucky person in that, you know, I made big bucks. I went through a lot of things that other players did, but I came out on top.
Did you undergo any kind of crisis when you retired from basketball, figuring out what to do next?
I did. That was a 2-year period where I didn't know what to do right after I retired from the game, and I was just lost. I went into the agent business representing other players, and I saw there was no future in that because the guys are not loyal. They're not thankful. Luckily, I started to work for the Knicks, Madison Square Garden Network, and announcing the games. And from that, the Atlanta Hawks hired me as an analyst, and then the book, which I'm promoting now, came along. So all of these things just started happening for me, good things. But I think it was brought on by my belief in God. Like there was a big void that I had to fill, and I got back into the church, and my life seemed to start on an upswing. You know, I started to become more giving and open and helping, more concerned about other people than myself. You know, I often tell my friends I'm more of a philanthropist now than a philanderer. So my life changed again. Like, I saw this big change in me, and that I really want to help other people, and especially kids. And today, a lot of my times I go into high schools and colleges talking about the importance of education and say no to drugs.
In your book, you wrote that after you retired from basketball, it took about 2 years before you could watch basketball on TV. I guess that was in part because you missed it. Or at least were ambivalent about not playing. What about now? Do you watch it now?
Yeah, well, there was a time when I didn't watch it, but I find that's common with all athletes. I was just reading an article about Tracy Austin and Andrew Yeager, you know, the two ex-tennis players, and they said the same thing. They said once they were injured, they couldn't watch tennis. They didn't watch it at all. So I find that to be true with all players, that once they leave the game for some strange reason, I don't think that I was bitter towards basketball, why I didn't watch it. I don't know. Maybe I was inside and didn't realize it, but I would not watch a game for those 2 years. Now, I have to because it's my occupation. I mean, I have to be aware of the games.
Of course,
yeah.
Of course.
But prior to that, I would read it in the paper. You know, I kept abreast of basically, I knew all the superstars. I didn't know all the different rosters like I know today, but I would watch it. But basically, the last 5 minutes of a game was the only part of the game that I could get interested in.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us about basketball and about your life. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Walt Frazier, and he was named to the Basketball Hall of Fame in 1987. He now operates a summer basketball camp on Staten Island and does commentary and analysis for New York Knicks basketball on the Madison Square Garden cable network. His new book, Walt Frazier, One Magic Season and a Basketball Life, is published by Times Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.